This meeting is now being recorded.
So, Larry, my question for you is, with those fine qualifications and all that experience and all the time you spend on this, would you be willing to share your compensation?
As the MasterCard commercial said, it's priceless.
Yeah, Larry is...
I am not compensated financially.
No, but in many other ways, and one of those is great appreciation from me and the staff and the board and the association. So next, I'd like to move to the performance report, and that. That is found in the packet that you would have received if you had registered. If you haven't registered, you can actually go to our website, which is www.uucef, so that stands for UU Common Endowment Fund, uucef.org. And over on the right-hand side, about halfway down, you will see a link to the materials to go with this call. We have good results. I guess I'd like to start with the slide for the returns as of June 30th, and that is slide 5. So the returns for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2014 were solid. The absolute return for the year, net of all expenses and fees, was 14.7%, and that's outstanding. As an absolute return, it matches up well with the benchmarks. We didn't really outperform by much, a little bit on the allocation index, a little shy of the policy index, but it is definitely a solid return. The three-year return was 7.1%, and the five-year return was 11.5%. And that was led by the domestic equity returns. U.S. stocks did very well in the fiscal year. They were up 27%. They were up 24.6%. Our portfolio in that area was up 27%. International was also a solid return at 17.9%. That slightly lagged the indices. And then the fixed income returns were lower, but as expected, about 6.5%. But that outperformed substantially as well. It outperformed a benchmark of 4.4%. We try to operate a very diversified portfolio. So in addition to kind of standard stocks and bonds, the portfolio also includes 30% of the fund in something called GTAA, or Global Tactical Asset Allocation. And these are three different managers that manage portfolios where they have the latitude to move among different asset classes as opportunities present themselves. And for the year, they outperformed their benchmark by a little over a percentage point. And then we also have an allocation of 5% to a fund of hedge funds. And that also outperformed substantially. That came in at 10.5%, and the benchmark was about 7.7%. So overall, the portfolio did quite well. We're happy about that. If you go to slide 6, you can see the allocation targets for the portfolio. The first column, labeled policy, those are the targets that we rebalance to every quarter. So we always try to keep the portfolio matching up with those policy targets. You can see that the second column, which says current, those are the actual allocations, and they are a little bit different than the policy, and this is in part because the committee in May had made some decisions about changing some of the targets, and that process takes a bit of time, and so those reallocations were not yet allocated directly to the policy. And then the last column is takes those global tactical asset allocation funds, those three funds, which, as I said, are really funds of funds investing in stocks, bonds, and other assets. And it breaks those out into their component parts so you can see exactly where we are invested. And then over on the right on that page, you can see the actual dollar amounts, the policy percentage, the current percentage, and the actual percentage. And then the other thing that's worth looking at is the next page, page 7. So we benchmark ourselves against the standard benchmarks, in other words, the S&P 500 and the Barclays aggregate for bonds and other standard benchmarks for different asset classes. But we also like to look at how we did against other similar investment funds. So we have access through our consultant to a database of several hundred endowments, and they compare us to a group of endowments that are of similar size, about 50 million to 250 million, and we measure ourselves according to a percentile rank. So if you look at the third column, it says fiscal year to date at the top. And down towards the bottom, you can see the composite. The composite for the last year, we were at the 46th percentile, which means slightly above average. And if you look at the 3 years, 64th percentile, slightly below average. But if you look at longer term, 5 years, 7 years, and 10 years, we actually do quite well and up near the upper quarter. So we are long-term investors. That's where we like to keep our attention on the 3, 5, and 7 years. And so I think over that market cycle, we have done quite well. With that, I think that's enough on this report. So I'd like to kick it back to Larry, who, as an ex officio member of the investment committee, was at the last committee so Larry could report on that meeting, the new members, and the actions of that committee. Go ahead, Larry.
Thank you, Tim. The committee meets, I think, about four times a year in person, and the committee, as you may know, is made up almost entirely of investment experts. There are a few people who are like me who are not deep investment experts but know enough to exercise good judgment. The committee began by hearing from its consultant about all. Basically, the consultant does kind of independent staff work for the committee, and so the first item we get from the consultant is the report on performance that you just heard from Tim, and we go through that with great care. To make sure we understand what is going well, what is not, trying to determine what the short-term and long-term implications are. So we heard that all from the independent investment consultant. The consultant also did a review of the fees that we pay to our investment managers, which is another consistent practice of the investment committee to make sure we are the fees we pay are competitive and not excessive. The results of that analysis were that about 70% of the managers we use we pay less fees than similar managers we would be paying in the. And in the remainder of the cases, our fees are slightly higher, but the returns those managers generate justify those higher fees. So it was a a good review to have done and a review that the committee will continue to do. We also receive a report on the socially responsible investing practices of the various managers so that those that can be monitored and we can be aware of what those practices are, any changes that might have occurred in those practices. We also receive updates on any other significant information that might be important relative to the individual managers. And for instance, two of the managers are on what's called watch, which means there are changes in the management, internal management of those managers. And while we don't want to fire them, we want to pay special attention to those managers because it's possible that those changes could have either a positive or a negative impact over time. We also had a very long discussion and have actually continued a discussion from prior meetings about what are often called illiquid investments. And those are investments like real estate, which is the most common kind of investments. At the size of endowment of the common endowment fund, some endowments of those sizes have such investments, and some do not. The larger the endowment, the more likely you will have a significant allocation to illiquid investments. It just adds to the diversity of the asset allocation, which over time almost always produces better returns. But the smaller you are, there are some potentially negative consequences of investing in illiquid assets, particularly the quality of the managers available to you. So the committee has been very careful about whether or not to do that kind of an asset allocation. At this meeting, the committee did conclude that it would be wise to allocate up to 10% of the overall endowment in illiquid assets, but didn't actually make that level of an allocation at this time. Changes in asset allocation would need to take place slowly over a long period of time to make sure you do it right and don't just jump in. We did hear from two potential managers in those areas, and I learned a phrase I hadn't known much about before called green real estate. So we talked with a firm that invests only in real estate that has a high LEEDS rating. So we learned quite a bit about those kind of firms and the successes and risks associated with those. We did not make an allocation to that particular firm, but we learned a lot. Secondly, we heard from an investment manager that invest in what are called green bonds, which are fixed income instruments where you're buying bonds that having some kind of a positive impact, positive social impact. So in my memory, the most interesting one was bonds in the African Development Bank that finance renewable energy conservation, energy efficiency, solid water, solid waste management, and those kinds of projects in Africa. And the committee did decide to allocate money to the green bond firm that we did talk to. And we did it by taking about half of the fixed income money allocated to PIMCO. If you look at the performance slides and the slide that show the individual managers, what you'll see one of the fixed income managers is PIMCO. And that's a perfectly fine firm, but actually one of those, one of the two firms that is on watch at the moment because of internal management changes that have been going on there. So we did decide to allocate about half of the money that is now handled by PIMCO to this this green bond manager.
Breckenridge.
Is still, pardon?
Breckenridge.
Breckenridge, yes. And that firm, over time, Tim will handle that allocation and it will go there. It has a good record, both in terms of returns and in terms of the good that it does in the world. Lastly, I'll say that we had two new members of the committee join us. As you may know, the investment committee members have two-year terms renewable three times for a total of 8 years. So there is a strong continuity on the committee, but also the opportunity to bring in new talent as well. And we've had two new members join us who have exceptionally strong institutional investment experience, much of it in endowment management. So one is Lucia Santini-Field, who had previously served on the investment committee for an eight-year term, and I believe six of those years as chair of the investment committee. And she has rejoined the committee. She is a senior vice president and portfolio manager at, I think, U.S. Trust Company, and manages, over $1 billion of investment assets, mostly for not-for-profits with a specialty in socially responsible investing. She's also currently serving as president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, but she has the time to do this. And we also added John LaPan, who also manages large amounts of institutional investment money. I'm going to look up and see if I can actually find what firm he works for, Federal Street Advisors. He is the head of that firm that manages about $4 billion in assets. He also brings, like Lucia, that very significant institutional investment experience. And combined, they represent about seven decades of experience. That kind of experience, particularly on a committee like this, is important because they've experienced down markets and up markets, and they've experienced every imaginable investment fad. So they bring that kind of perspective to the work so that the focus stays on meaningful asset allocation and a focus exclusively on long-term performance. So that's the investment committee update.
That's great, Larry. Thanks very much. And I'd just like to emphasize how grateful we are to all these committee members. I mean, they all are, very experienced professionals who could make a lot of money doing other things but choose to volunteer their time to serve the association and its congregations on the committee. So the day after the investment committee met, we had a meeting of our committee on socially responsible investing. I also serve ex officio on that committee. And today we've got David Stewart, who is the co-chair of that committee, with us to give a report on that committee's work. David?
Thank you, Tim. As Tim said, I'm the co-chair of the Socially Responsible Investment Committee. Our role is to ensure that there is a healthy tension at the, you know, between the IC and the socially responsible aspects of what they're doing, their first responsibility being the fiduciary, of course. And the board has charged both of these committees with this work, and so basically we have to try to work within the guidelines that the board has charged us to educate folks about socially responsible investing and what we're doing. Also to try to encourage the IC whenever possible within the constraints they have to do socially responsible investing and to manage the various aspects of that. And so basically you folks are probably aware of the aspects of socially responsible investing, but just in case, those are screening, negative screening, removing out stocks, and a good example of that is the recent divestment proposal that passed General Assembly. For those of you who are not aware, that passed overwhelmingly to divest from the Carbon Tracker 200 fossil fuel companies, and we are in the process of excluding those companies where we are not engaged with them and where it makes fiduciary sense. Next, as far as socially responsible investing, there's shareholder activism, which we have an expert on our committee, as well as Tim Brennan, who actively engage with boards and with other shareholders to try to put forth votes in order to pressure companies to do the right thing as we see it. That may range from providing rights to LGBT employees so that they are not discriminated against, or things like working on methane emissions with natural gas companies. So that's part and parcel of our work. That's the core of it, really. Another thing is voting our proxies. So we make sure that we use our shares when we do own them to let our voice be heard, that UU values are voted. And then finally, community investing, which is setting aside a portion of the fund, 1%, to help with access to capital for communities that have had little access to capital in the past, typically communities of color. So the action items that we took from this General Assembly, just as a point so that you all know what's going on with regard to the SRI committee, we're putting in place a manual exclusion of those Carbon Tracker 200 companies that we do not hold as of 6:30. We're looking at that list at the spring meeting to make sure that everything has been in place properly. We're creating a list that are held in the advocacy account, and the advocacy account is, for those of you who are not aware, is the account where we hold minimal shares and do shareholder advocacy via a minimal holding. That is not as effective, but in some cases that is what we've chosen to do. And then finally, we're creating an advocacy plan, an overall advocacy plan based on the holdings that we do maintain in the Carbon Tracker 200 so that we're in compliance with what we have advocated and agreed to at the General Assembly via the divestment proposal. Tim, do you think that covers what we need?
Yeah, that's great. That's great, David. Great summary. So in a minute, I think we'll start with some questions. But I did want to point to one thing in your report that I did not mention. And I'm not going to go through this because it's fairly lengthy. But if you go to page 10, you can see a summary of all the managers in the fund. So again, we try to have diversification of the EU Common Endowment Fund across asset classes, in other words, stocks, bonds, hedge funds, et cetera, but also across managers so that, for instance, in the U.S. equity space, we have three different managers with three different approaches to investing. And we think this is the best approach. But I often get questions from people, you know, about different managers. And this document here provides a summary of each individual manager and gives you an idea of the unique role that each of them plays in the endowment. So I refer you to that. Okay, so let's open up the lines to questions. I believe I have this set up so that if you push star 6, you can unmute your line and ask a question. And then I would ask you when you're done to press star 6 again to mute it so we don't get a bunch of ambient noise. So does somebody want to test the system and press star 6 and ask a question? And why don't you identify yourself and your congregation when you do so?
I pressed star 6. If I speak now, continue, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm Bob Barger. I'm with the UU Fellowship in Marion County, Florida. We are one $10,000 gift away from joining you guys.
Great.
My proposal to our fellowship in writing is that we do just that. And I have two key numbers questions so far that I could use help on for the best answer. One is, has anybody tried to justify the 1% fee that all investment managers of this kind charge in total for their services versus do-it-yourself within a little congregation? I have my own answer, but I need a better one from you. And the second is not written down, so I'll just stick with the first one.
Okay, this is Tim. I'll take a crack at that. First of all, the thing that's important for you to understand about the what we charge folks in the Common Endowment Fund is that it is a pass-through of actual costs, with one small exception. So what we charge, that is the UUA, what the UUA charges congregations to cover our expenses is 0.2%, or some people like to use the term 20 basis points. But we charge 0.2%. Everything else is a pass-through of the actual cost of running the fund. So most of that, about 0.6% or 60 basis points, represents the fees charged by each one of the underlying managers. And I think if you went out on your own, you would have a darn hard time trying to find managers of this quality and this level of diversification for 0.6%. In fact, I dare say it would be impossible. And then the rest of the costs, so that's, another 0.3% or so, it's made up of things like the investment management, investment consultant fee, and I think you've already heard Larry talking about the value they bring and as far as vetting, selecting, and monitoring managers and setting our overall policies. The fund is actually audited. I think that is as valuable to you all as investors, that you know it's not just Tim Brennan telling you what's in your account, but it's a top auditing firm comes in and vets the entire accounting of our common endowment. And then the custodial fee, and that's important, too, because that means that the UUA is not actually – we don't actually have our hands on your money. Your money is being held over at State Street Bank in a custodial account. So that's what makes up the fee, and I think it's reasonable and fair, but that's for each congregation to make their own judgment about. But I don't think you're going to get manager fees as low as we get, because remember we have $180 million, so we're getting fairly low fees because it's a volume business for the managers, and we're also getting a level of diversification and guidance that you wouldn't get otherwise.
Yeah,
that help,
if I can, If I could add, Tim, there's also the SRI piece of it as well. So don't forget, doing this SRI.
That was going to be my next question. Yes, thank you. Is this David?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's the other question. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's actually fairly difficult to even for us to do. There is that tension between fiduciary and SRI, but basically I would just say that, you know, we make a strenuous effort to make sure that this money, this endowment, speaks to you values. So it's an important piece of it, I believe.
Well,
yeah,
let me try it this way. You guys haven't given me any numbers. All you've given me is the words that, to tell the truth, I've already used, and my guys are saying, hey, give me some numbers or stop talking to me, Bob. So I'm wondering if there's any way to correlate any of the indices that you use with that second question with respect to the effect on total return of the SRI piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way to look at this is, you know, when I was going through the numbers earlier, I was comparing our returns to benchmarks. Now, those are not SRI benchmarks. Those are standardized benchmarks. So, you know, the gross return for the portfolio for the year ending in June was 15.9%, and that compares to an index return of 14.5. So that's outperformance by 1.4%. And we have a rigorous program of socially responsible investing. Or the other way to look at it is, as I said before, is to compare us to other like-sized endowments, most of which do not have, you know, rigorous SRI programs. And over the last, you know, 5 years, we've performed in the upper 6%. So to me, those are the numbers that tell us that we're not being hurt, or at least not hurt much by pursuing this program. It's interesting you asked this question. I just spent 2 hours before this call at a meeting with MFS asset managers. They are an international equity manager that we use, and they were going through a report that they've put together. They wanted our input on it about how looking at environmental, social, and governance issues, if you're a long-term investor, that adds value. Now, they're not known as they're not an SRI manager. They're a straight manager, but they have come to the conclusion that if you don't pay attention to environmental, social, and governance issue, you're missing the boat. You're adding risk to your portfolio, and you're missing opportunities for outsized gains.
If I can use that, I would appreciate it.
Well, you can quote that for sure. The report that they gave me is not yet public. They're vetting it right now with various clients. They did the report in conjunction with MIT and really came up with some pretty interesting data that supports their position.
Wonderful.
Hi,
okay,
this is
go ahead.
Next question. This is Lucia Savage from All Souls, Washington, D.C., and I have a completely different kind of question. I wanted to go back to the decision about the illiquid assets, and my question is the nature of an asset as illiquid going to be applied to each of the classes in your asset class, or does it become an additional asset class and everything gets reallocated accordingly?
Larry, do you want to talk about that, or you want me to?
Well, it is a separate asset class.
Do you guys have a plan for it? So it becomes a new asset class. That means, you know, 100% is still only 100%. Do you have documentation of, you know, not only the trend for how you're going to grow that class, but also that trend for how the other asset classes are then going to be allocated?
Well, I think it's safe to say that that will be a slow, iterative process. So it will not be one big step or one big change. As I mentioned, a small amount of money has now been allocated. No money yet has been allocated to this particular asset class. So I think what will happen is the committee will look at the various choices of individual managers and types of asset classes within the illiquid area and gradually shift. Some assets into that class. So it will not be fast. And some circumstances are always different. So making a plan, I'm reminded of that old Yiddish proverb, man plans, God laughs. The circumstances will be different when we actually get to the point of making a particular allocation. Usually what happens is you look at when you have a need for to allocate money to a new asset class is you look at which asset class are we really over-allocated to already. So if domestic equities is supposed to be 30% of your asset classes and it's at 28%, which is, say, higher than all the other allocations, you'd probably take it from that particular class. But the change would happen once we identify a particular manager. And that could be quite a ways off.
Yeah. So the New England Pension Consultants, which, by the way, has been advising us to make an allocation to illiquid assets, private equity, and real estate for some time. What they're going to do is come back to us at the next meeting with a staging plan. So exactly your question about if we did allocate 5 or 10% to one of these managers, what would happen to the rest of the portfolio? What would that look like, and how would that affect projected return and projected volatility? So as Larry said, this is a process we're embarking on. No actual investments have been made. The other thing to say is that this does not change the liquidity of the congregations. So we offer our congregations monthly liquidity. We will continue to do that, and we can do that because the UUA's share of the endowment is about half. So if we're allocating 10% to an illiquid investment, even if we couldn't get to that to satisfy a need of a congregation for liquidity, there's plenty of other assets that are easily changed to cash for a distribution. So the congregations will continue to get their monthly liquidity just as they do now. It will some level of complexity and risk because illiquid assets are, should we say, kind of coarsely valued until you get near the end of the holding period, because illiquid assets typically then get sold at some point down the road, 5 or 7 years down the road, and that's really the point at which you know how much a firm is worth or a piece of real estate. You don't really know along the way. So that will be something that our investors will have to live with. Is that helpful?
Yes, and I have a follow-up question if you don't mind. Sorry if this is something you've gone over. I know you guys have been working on this illiquid thing for a little while. And so it's also true, however, that managing a real estate portfolio has a much higher investment management cost than a stock or bond-based portfolio. So do you have what's your plan for sort of ameliorating the cost impact of those higher fees?
Well, the reason one would do it is because the expected net return is higher.
Okay.
And that's what we really depend on our investment consultant for, to help us find those best-in-class managers to get in on those accounts. If we can't find somebody that satisfies our needs, that we have a lot of confidence would give us solid returns at a fee that's reasonable for, you know, their track record and skill set, we wouldn't do it. We feel no pressure to go in this direction. But I guess the other thing to say is that our investment consultant, and this is consistent with other things I read, says that the actual outlook for equities, for stocks, over the next 5 years or so, that's both U.S. and international, it's not great. I mean, we've seen some great returns over the last year, but the outlook is not terrific because growth outlook is not terrific. So that means, you know, the long-term expected return for the portfolio would be something in the, you know, like 6.5%. Well, if you want to pay out 5% and inflation is 2%, that means you'd be going backwards. So that's sort of the driver that says, are there asset classes out there that could generate higher returns? And our investment consultant has recommended that if we move towards some of, I mean, you get paid for the illiquidity. And that there is upside there, higher expected return than for publicly traded stocks, and that is one of the reasons to do that. And then maybe the other thing to say is another reason to do that is there are opportunities in the private space that that are you know say sustainability driven investments. Climate solutions investments, and that those could be attractive, and those will be a part of the deliberation to see what where we want to go with this.
Okay, thank you.
This is Beth in Ashland, Oregon. Beth Coy,
Beth.
Do you hear me? I've got a simple question. I can't get an easy answer. About a year ago, we had an unrestricted gift, a very large one, come in, and person had passed away, and our policy, not a bylaw, but a policy, is that it goes 50-50, 50 to the operating and 50 to the endowment, which we acted upon. But and we, by the way, are separate from the board. We are endowment trust, and we report to the congregation. So now we've got some need on the operating side for some of that endowment 50%. Let's say it's $45,000. And it's causing a lot of friction among the trustees, some of us, as well as the board, because we can't get a clear answer as to can we get that, can we now take that, some of that endowment money and give it back to, transfer it to the operating fund. I cannot get a simple answer. Is there an answer?
I think the simple answer is that the restriction on the funds, to the extent there's a permanent restriction on the funds, it can only be set by the donor. So if the donor gave the money to the congregation on an unrestricted basis, and then the board or the congregation decided to allocate it 50% to endowment, 50% to operating, you can change your mind. On the other hand, if the donor said, this is permanently restricted, you're bound by law to honor
right.
that restriction.
I know that, but this is not. This was totally unrestricted charitable gift. And so the board and the trustees can come to a change, right, in the policy
right.
or change somehow?
Right. And right. So whoever set that policy, if it was the board can change it. If it was the congregation.
No, it was the board and the trustees. I signed it many years ago. Yes.
Yeah. So then it's just it's a judgment call. And I know Larry might want to say something about that, but it's a policy decision. And
that's what I thought. But, boy, I tell you, to change that policy, donors, endowment folks are saying, no, once it's into the endowment, that's it. And I say, no, that's not the same as a donor-restricted.
Yeah.
But I cannot get anything clear online, or I'd like to have something in writing if I could.
Tim is right that it's, legally, only a donor can restrict the use of funds. So if the bequest was then voted by the trustees or the congregation to go into endowment, the trustees and or the congregation can vote to take it out of endowment. It is still a matter of opinion of whether you should.
Yes.
And so those who don't want to take it out can say, but it's wrong, and that's a reasonable argument to make, but they can't say it's legally wrong unless Oregon has
different laws than every other state in the union.
Oh, no, the Uniform Act and so forth. Okay, you're just confirming what I know. I just wanted to get that. I wish to get it in. The other way to go, of course,
it is a common
off the top
belief.
Of the endowment. Just take it off. Vote, you know, the congregation vote for that. But I'd rather do it the other way.
But it is you're dealing with a common belief that that trustees can permanently restrict something, but they can't.
Thank you, Larry. That's what I'm going to say. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, is there another question?
Hey, this is Scott Brosland in Corvallis, Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Corvallis, Oregon. Another Oregon call. Hey, Larry,
yeah,
can you take credit for finding either Jim or Carol and putting them on the board? They were great. Got Carol still in there, I hope.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, can Larry take credit for finding them?
No, he can't.
Okay. Hey, but I've got a quick question. I emailed it to Susan just a little while ago, because it came up in our meeting on Sunday about the collaboration between the National Resource Defense Council, FTSE, and BlackRock having an ex-fossil fuel index that's institutional only. Is that, you guys, maybe David could shed a little light on that, or is that something that's up on your radar? No, I'm going to star myself, star six. Thanks.
Yeah, I can't actually say that that's on my radar. I'm not aware of that particular index. So.
Yeah, this is Tim. Yeah, I've been following that. I've heard something about it. I don't think at this time UUA is particularly interested in that because, you know, we have as I was explaining before, we already have a very robust program for screening, particularly our U.S. equities. We have an arrangement with Sustainalytics, which is one of the top socially responsible investment analytical firms in the world, and they do a custom analysis of the Russell 1000 for us twice a year. And, you know, we have the flexibility to impose standards and restrictions and kind of adjust, you know, like if we want to look more closely at carbon footprint, we can do that. So as David said, you know, we're looking closely at what we can do in line with that resolution that was passed by the General Assembly. But remember that resolution was also an endorsement of our shareholder advocacy program. So there have been a couple blogs actually out in the blogosphere talking about how the UUA got it right by not just divesting, but by talking about divestment in concert with an aggressive program of shareholder advocacy. So I don't think that particular index is going to be right for us, although I'm keeping my eye on it. But it will be interesting to learn from it and see, because the trick, of course, is to not just take those companies out, but to balance your portfolio with other stocks that have a similar kind of risk return profile, but are not in that, you know, particular industry sector. So we're working with our index management firm, Rumline, to actually see what the effect of making some of those changes might be. But it is interesting to see that happening in the kind of more mainstream investment field. So I think with that, we're going to have to bring the call to a close. We did promise you it would be a one-hour call. We don't want to take extra time. But if there are questions that are, you know, you wished you would have had a chance to ask, please feel free to contact me or Susan Helbert here at the UUA. We're always happy to answer your questions. I'm easily accessible at tbrennan@uua.org. And if you can't remember that, it's just treasurer@uua.org. That comes right to my inbox. Or Susan at shelbert@uua.org. And we will get back to you with the best answers that we can. Also, remember that this call has been recorded and will be posted on the website. So if you have other congregants, friends, or committee members that you think would benefit from the call, please send them in that direction. It'll probably take us a couple days to get it posted. And so with that, special thanks to Larry. Larry is actually off on some idyllic island someplace vacationing and came to us. I hope you didn't have to go to a telephone, Larry, that you were able to get in over your computer. And also David for taking time out of his busy day to be with us. And thanks to both of you for your service on the committees. It's really invaluable. So thanks to everybody. Have a good rest of your summer.
You too.
Bye.